Hello, and welcome to Understanding My PPP Loan and Other CARES Act Options Available webinar, presented by Tulsa Netlink. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website, as well as our COVID-19 blog. If you have questions regarding today's content, please reach out to our COVID-19 task force. This contact information can be found on our COVID-19 blog. To access the COVID-19 blog, please reference the resources tab located next to the speaker bios. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the technical support box. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the resources tab. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Tulsa Netlink shareholder, Phil Bacon.
Thank you, Ashley. Ashley, there's something in the background. If you're able to cut out that noise, that would be great. So I want to welcome everybody and talk about what we're going to do today. First of all, I would say that all the things we're going to talk about are very new, all within the last 6 months, some of them within the last 6 days. And so they're unprecedented, not tested under the law. And the guidance we're going to give is to the best of our ability and knowledge that we know at the time. But it's hard to be definitive about anything that has been so new, so untested, and so unprecedented. So the first thing, we're going to spend about 25 to 30 minutes talking about the Paycheck Protection Program. We'll talk about the certification process that's been ongoing and changing, and then also the forgiveness part of the program. After that, we're going to look at some of the tax features of the CARES Act, some of the employment and employee benefits issues, and then we're going to wind up with what's going to happen in the future, what we're predicting will happen down the pike. So let's talk about the Paycheck Protection Program and how we got where we are. The CARES Act established the Paycheck Protection Program and immediately allocated $350 billion to the program. The SBA and the Treasury Department had a scramble to start getting the money out as soon as possible. They needed to get banks on board and banks figuring out an application process. And they had overwhelming amount of applications and folks who wanted to receive the money under the program. And all the rules and regulations had not been established, and much of the guidance had not come out. So that's just sort of giving you the background of how we got here today. The main focus of the Paycheck Protection Program was to use funds for payroll costs. Some of the funds could also be used for rent, utilities, and interest payments on the mortgage. And it had probably the most intriguing feature of all of the SBA programs and all of the CARES Act programs, in that there was a forgiveness feature. As long as you use the money for payroll, mortgage interest payments, rent, and utility payments, you were eligible to get forgiveness on pretty much all of the amounts that you used if you followed certain rules. The whole idea was also that you wanted to keep people employed. So the forgiveness feature was all about keeping people with salaries up and FTEs employed. And the more you did that, the more you were eligible for forgiveness. Lastly, the SBA came out and said, hey, we want the majority of this to be used for payroll. So in order to get forgiveness, you had to use the money 3-to-1 payroll towards that, and the lower amount for mortgage interest, rent, and utility payments. It's important to realize you cannot use any of the money, whether you get forgiveness or not, for anything other than those items. You can't use it for operating capital. Can't use it to pay down debt. You have to use it for the things that were articulated in the act. So the other attribute that people sometimes forget and should be looking at if they've received money under the program is not to forget about the fact that you had to include affiliation in your test when getting the amount of money you could get under the loan. What does that mean? That means if you're controlled by an entity, you have to look at how many employees that entity may have, as well as any other folks that they control, in aggregating the number of employees or the financial information for approval for a loan and qualifying under the PPP rules. A very common scenario for that is, let's say you had a business that was controlled by a PE firm. They owned more than 50% of you. Well, you'd have to aggregate your employees or your financials with every other business, regardless if it was a similar business, for purposes of determining whether you qualified under the rules. And I would say for those who receive loans, if you didn't do that, you hadn't thought about it, now would be a very good time to go back and think about it before you spend the money, or before the money turns into a loan if it's not forgiven. You also need to remember that control doesn't always mean somebody owns more than 50% of your stock. There can also be rights through a management company or minority rights that a shareholder has that control everyday items, things like compensation, the ability to fire employees, the ability to get new debt for the company, that are indicia of control and require an affiliation analysis. There's certain things that are exempt from the affiliation rules. One of probably the biggest ones is your business had received an SBIC investment. You don't need to apply affiliation rules. If you're in the hospitality industry and your NAIC S code starts with a 72, or if you're a franchise, you may have the ability to be exempt from affiliation. All right, let's get into more of the meat of where we are now. Most people have received their loans. They applied for them, and now the bank has either said you've been approved or you've actually got the money in the bank account. Well, when you applied for the loan, you had to make a certification. At the time you applied for the loan, the applicant had to certify that in good faith, current economic uncertainty makes the loan request necessary to support ongoing operations. Very, very broad language, language that most everybody who applied for the loan could in good faith say, yeah, they had some need for the loan based on the economic uncertainty caused by COVID or things related to that. That went along fine for about the first three weeks of this program. And then things started to get out in the media. Most of you have probably heard there was scrutiny over the fact that Shake Shack took money, that other large restaurants or subsidiaries of public companies took money under the program. More recently, you might have heard that the LA Lakers took money, and there was a lot of political pressure. So on April 23rd, the SBA came out with a FAQ, and the FAQs have been said in putting them out that those are guidance that need to be relied on and are looked at very similar to regulations or law. And this new FAQ said, in certifying necessity of PPP loans, borrowers must take into account their current business activity and their ability to access other sorts of liquidity to sufficient to support the ongoing operation in a manner that's not significantly detrimental to the business. So all of a sudden, a new requirement appeared. When you may have first applied for the loan, nobody suggested, needed, or was there, were you told that you needed to assess your liquidity in making a determination of whether you should get the loan. But now the SBA said you do, despite the fact, and some people might say, well, there was an earlier FAQ that came out that said you could rely on the rules and regulations that were in process at the time you applied for the loan. Well, despite that fact, they later adopted this FAQ and said you got to go back and you got to look at your liquidity and see if you really qualify for this loan. They further said it's unlikely that a public company with substantial market value and access to capital markets will be able to make the required certification in good faith. Well, so everybody said, all right, I'm not a public company. I'm not affiliated with a public company. I don't have to worry about that. Well, 5 days later, the SBA came out with another FAQ and said, oh no, this also applies in the private company realm as well. But they said, don't worry, we understand, we changed the rules here, and they put out question 31 as it's now known. And they said any borrower that applied for a PPP loan prior to April 23rd or April 28th that repays the loan in full by May 7th, which is this Thursday, will be deemed to, by SBA to have made the required certification in good faith. So basically what they said is you need to go back and reassess whether you really needed this loan, whether there was existing liquidity, go back and look at it as of the time you applied for the loan, but remake that certification now. And if you can't determine that you need the loan based on this new standard, you should pay back the loan, and we're not going to come after you. You're not going to need to worry about it, provided you give us the money back by May 7th, 2020. And that kind of turned things into a lot of turmoil because people said, what do I do? How do I go about handling this? And what happens if I keep the money longer and then return it? What might happen to me? Can I just take the money? And if the government determines that I should have taken it, pay it back. Well, Secretary Mnuchin came out and made some statements, and they're important for the context of what's going on and making and doing the decision making. Secretary Mnuchin said for any loan over $2 million, the SBA is going to do an audit. And the audit will look at both whether you properly made determinations for forgiveness, which everybody assumed would happen, but they'll also look at whether you are eligible for the loan. He further said there are severe consequences for people who don't attest properly to the certifications. And he talked about the banks and said, hey, this isn't the bank's problem. Banks, don't worry about it. You don't need to worry about whether your borrower should have had the loan or not. This is on the borrower. The borrower should have thought about this. They should go back and think about it now and make a determination whether you should keep the money or not. And that had a little effect with respect to the banks because people in the industry or people who have taken the loans have said, hey, my bank doesn't necessarily care. They urged me to take the loan. They said it would be a good idea. So the important takeaway from that is you have to make a decision here, not the bank. There have been banks that have provided notices to all their borrowers and say, hey, these are the new rules. You have to look at the new rules, and you need to decide whether you should properly keep the money or not. The other thing I would say, a little scary, but Attorney General Barr said it's a priority to prioritize the detection, investigation, and prosecution of all criminal conduct related to this pandemic. You should know that the Treasury Department has established a special inspector general, and they've provided tremendous amount of funding for these audits to occur, for enforcement of the rules to occur. And it's something you should think about and be aware of. So this is really very serious what they're asking people to do. So let's talk about what you could do. How do you make this decision? And it's a hard thing to do. There's no precedent for it. There's no guidance to say in the past you know, the SBA has said this is okay, but this isn't okay. So what we're saying is you need to use best practices. You need to really consider what you're doing. And how can you do that? If you've received the money, you should go back and do another analysis. Add the liquidity to your analysis and put it all in documentation and go to your board or your management or whoever the decision makers are and really conduct your fiduciary duties and say, all right, given the new information, do we need this money? Can we make a good faith analysis that we need this money? And let's make that decision before we May 7th and decide whether we need to give the money back or not. In fairness of what you're doing, you can look at the impact of the pandemic on your business. You can do an analysis of how your business has been affected by demand, whether you've had to have closings, whether you've had to change the employment status of people. You can go ahead and look at your forecast, and you don't have to be right about your forecast, but you have to make a forecast. Think about why you've made this forecast so that you know what you're relying on in making the decision. You can include financial projections. You don't have to necessarily change what you've previously done. You need to just be consistent with what you're doing. And do what you've done in the past in making decisions. And then you need to look at liquidity options. This is probably the biggest thing that has changed since you may have given your application in and received the loan. You need to look at, well, do you have an ability to draw down debt? If you did have the ability to draw down debt, what was the cost of it? How much more money would it have given you? And what would you have used it for? That doesn't mean necessarily that if you had a line of credit, you would have to draw down on the line of credit to pay your employees. If you have it earmarked for other things that your business is going to need to be doing in other ways that your business needs to stay afloat, then that's okay. But put together a document that talks about this, what you were planning on using it for, and put that into your decision-making process. Also look at, do you have shareholders? Do you have investors? And would they be willing to put in more money? They don't have to necessarily be willing to put it in. Or would it come at a great cost to your business? They don't have to. Then you can determine, hey, I can make a good faith determination. Would that have been the proper thing for my business to do? Look at long and short term needs and how that would affect your business. Also look at what you would have done with the employees. Would you have had to lay off people? Would you have reduced salaries? How does that change by getting this money in consideration with any other money you might have? And then the last thing that we're suggesting people do is do what for years been known as the New York Times analysis. You can now call it the LA Laker analysis. If you had to defend yourself, if you had to say, publicly, is this money I needed? What would the outcome of that be? And how do you feel about that? Because that plays into decision making and what you might do. So let's turn it over to Sarah here, and she's going to talk about loan forgiveness. And assuming you take the loan, assuming that you're comfortable with it or you didn't have a need to give it back because of liquidity, we also want you to be able to understand how the forgiveness factor works and maximize that. So, Sarah, you want to take it from here?
Yes, thanks, Phil. And I will note, you know, similar to what Phil said at the beginning of this, there hasn't been additional guidance. Well, there's been one additional piece of guidance since the CARES Act, but other than that, there's been no additional guidance on the forgiveness portion of the PPP. The Treasury issued a new FAQ over the weekend that hints that they are putting together forgiveness guidance, and so we are hoping that we'll get that soon, as we know that many of you have already received your funds and are trying to figure out the best way to spend them. So first and foremost, your maximum forgivable amount is the sum of payroll costs, rent, utilities, and payment on mortgage interest in the 8 weeks beginning on the disbursement of the loan. I'd like to reiterate that those are the only things that you can spend this loan on, whether it's forgivable or not. You cannot spend the loan on anything but those four things. If you do, it's going to be considered a misuse of funds, and there could be all sorts of consequences from the SBA and or the Treasury. So payroll costs is bigger than just salaries. It includes employer contributions, retirement plans, payment for employee benefits, including insurance premiums for health care, payment of state and local taxes, employee vacation, parental, family, medical, and sick leave, and then, of course, wages and compensation, but it's capped at $100,000. So during that eight-week period, all cash compensation needs to be annualized to a maximum of $100,000. You cannot use the loan to pay your employees more than that. If you want to pay them more than that, that needs to come from separate funds, and you really need to be able to document that. Utilities includes gas, water, electricity, telephone, internet access, and transportation, which was given no definition. Your maximum forgivable amount is capped at 100% of the loan, and to obtain maximum forgiveness, it has to be 75% payroll and 25% non-payroll. The whole thing could be payroll, and that would be maximally forgivable. The issue is the greater your non-payroll cost, the less likely that you're going to get full forgiveness, because the focus on this program is really on the payroll cost. So what happens if you have layoffs? So your maximum forgivable amount can be reduced by any layoffs. This is determined by a fraction that is somewhat convoluted. What you do is you determine your average monthly full-time equivalent employees during the eight-week period. In the SBA world, full-time equivalent is 30 hours. So for everyone that works over 30 hours or above during a week, they're considered one employee. For everyone that works below that, you add all of their hours together and divide by 30, and that will give you your full-time equivalent employee number for part-time employees. So your numerator is average monthly full-time equivalent employees during the eight-week period. Your denominator are either average monthly full-time equivalent employees from January 1 to February 29th, 2020, or average monthly full-time equivalent employees from February 15th to June 30th, 2019. The reason why there are those two time periods is that some businesses scaled up really quickly at the end of 2019, and so their employment numbers may not really be representative of how many employees they tend to have. However, so basically, if you're looking at that number, you have your numerator, your denominator. If that's less than one, then you need to multiply it by your maximum forgivable amount, and that's your new forgivable amount. So you will see a proportional reduction on the basis of any loss in headcount as compared to your previous time period. However, if the layoffs occurred from February 15th to April 26th, 2020, and you rehire by June 30th, it will be as if that layoff did not occur. There are, of course, some open issues on that. For example, what if the person that you laid off was equal to 0.5 of an FTE? How do you determine what the FTEs are by June 30th? Because ostensibly, you need an entire week to determine if someone has 30 hours or above. There's not clear guidance there, and we're hoping that that will be clarified in the new Treasury guidance. They also recently clarified, okay, well, what happens if I try to rehire my employee and they don't come back? I'm sure many of you have heard about a number of establishments having that problem because unemployment is higher than their wages at the business. In that instance, if you can demonstrate that you gave a bona fide offer of employment and you have written documentation of the rejection of employment, then you will not be penalized for that person not coming back. So you will still receive the same, that will not result in a reduction of your forgivable amount. It is so that layoffs didn't occur because you tried to mitigate, but the employee was not responsive. So the second way that you can have a reduction in the amount of your forgiveness is based on reduced salaries. So this looks really at any reductions in excess of 25% of salary. So how you determine this, and so the layoff test is a headcount test. It says rehire, but it doesn't require that you rehire the same person. It just requires that you maintain a headcount. The salary is an employee-by-employee test. So you look at each employee that was employed by you in the most recent full quarter. You determine their total wages during that period. And then you determine their total wages during the 8-week period, and you compare them. We have a clear issue here of we're comparing a total amount during 12 weeks to a total amount during 8 weeks. We haven't gotten any guidance on how to mitigate that difference in time periods for comparison purposes. But going forward with the calculation, what you do is you determine if the amount that you're paying your employee during the 8-week period is 74% or less than what they made in the most recent full quarter, there will be a deduction based on that percentage change. So what that looks like is if 75% of what you pay them in that 8-week period would be $2,000, and you're paying them only $1,000 during that period, that $1,000 difference would be subtracted from your maximum forgivable amount. So the salary reductions can really add up. So that's something to bear in mind, that this is a by employee test. However, similar with layoffs, there is a way to mitigate this. If the salary reductions occurred from February 15th to April 26th, and you eliminate the reduction by June 30th, then it will be as though there was no salary reduction occurred. Open question here is, do you have to give back pay? You know, what does that mean you eliminate the reduction? Does that just mean that on June 30th, you bring their salary back up? Again, these are questions that we don't yet have answers to and are really hoping that the SBA issues more guidance. But for the time being, this is kind of the only way that you can mitigate how this reduction would impact your forgiveness. So how does the process work? You get to the end of your 8-week period, and then what? The thing that you need to be thinking about, the word that needs to be constantly in your brain during this 8-week period, is documentation. Because at the end of the 8-week period, you will need to provide documentation to your bank demonstrating exactly how you use the funds and proving that you deserve the forgivable amount that you think that you do. Your bank will then review. And when you think about it from the bank's perspective, they want to get fully reimbursed to the extent possible. So they're going to be really diligent in making sure that what you're applying for makes sense. Because if they give something to the SBA that the SBA rejects, one, that extends the time that they can get the reimbursement for, and two, you know, they don't want the SBA to think that there is some sort of issue. So the bank will look through all your documentation. They will then transmit it to the SBA. The SBA then has 60 days to review and reimburse the lender. So that's the process period. We're not sure if you're required to send in the documentation immediately when the 8 weeks end. We're not sure if, you know, let's say that your 8-week period ends June 16th and then you're trying to mitigate by June 30th, if you then have to give the documentation exactly on June 30th. There are a couple open items about process, and we think that will be in the new guidance as well. Another question is, if you got your loan, let's say that it was, you know, disbursed yesterday, 8 weeks may extend past June 30th. So we'll see if they also extend that June 30th date to allow for those that got their loans a little bit later to still have that mitigation feature. So the overarching thing for the PPP program is documentation, documentation, documentation. Documenting your eligibility, it's documenting your certification, it's documenting how you use the loan. So on that, I will pass you over to Bill Sanders to discuss tax credits.
Thanks, Sarah. The slide that's up now describes where we're going to go in the next 10 minutes or so, the tax credits and other tax provisions in the second and third COVID-19 pieces of legislation, the Family First Coronavirus Response Act, and then what's been more recently characterized as the CARES Act. And then we'll talk a little bit about some other notable tax items. Before I get to those, I'd first like to provide an update on the loan forgiveness piece that was alluded to by Sarah and Phil. Any PPP loan, obviously you'd like to have that forgiven by providing that documentation, as Sarah emphasized. In the original legislation, it was clear that that forgiveness, if it occurred, would not be taxable income. So you wouldn't have to pay tax on the benefit of having that loan be forgiven, which made entire sense, given what the program was all about. Well, the IRS, in its infinite wisdom, hopefully there's no IRS folks on the line, but recently, that was last Thursday, issued notice 2020-32, indicating that since the loan forgiveness is not taxable income, the deductions associated with the expenses that give rise to the loan forgiveness, so in other words, the wages and the rent and the interest, utilities, and so forth that you spend in order to be qualified for the loan forgiveness, won't be deductible for tax purposes. So they've effectively circumvented the legislative directive here that the benefit should not be taxed. There's tremendous congressional disappointment in that notice. It is, however, what the IRS intends to pursue at this point in time. We think the next round of legislative provisions, if not this next one, then the one following, hopefully will fix that and make the entire benefit non-taxable. Okay, so let's go to the credits associated with the first Family First Coronavirus Response Act. Both of these credits are available only if you have less than 500 employees and you're paying employees who cannot work for one of the identified reasons. First, the sick pay leave credit. And this particular credit is an either or credit. Either you're going to receive up to $511 a day or $200 a day in the form of a credit against your payroll taxes, depending on the reason why the employee is unable to work. If the employee is unable to work because of COVID-19 impacting them directly, that's the first one. That being, if they can't work because of a governmental order or local quarantine, or they've been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine, or they're showing symptoms of COVID-19 and they're seeking a medical diagnosis, those are the reasons why they can't work, then you will receive the lesser of $511 a day or their normal daily pay as a credit against your employment taxes. If, on the other hand, the employee can't work because of someone that they're caring for, in other words, that person, whether it be a child or a parent, family member, so forth, is quarantined or showing symptoms of COVID-19, or the employee's minor child isn't able to go to school or child care by virtue of those facilities being closed, then you can receive a credit equal to the lesser of $200 a day or two-thirds of their normal pay rate. So two-thirds of pay rate or 200, these are an either or. So whichever reason that they're not able to work for, then you pick. If they can't work for both reasons, then you're gonna pick obviously the one that pays more per day, 511. This is up to 10 days. So the maximum credit is 5,110 for the first, 2,000 for the second. In addition, you're able to get additional credits relating to the healthcare costs associated with that employee, once again, if they're not able to work and you're continuing to pay them. Okay, the second credit is the family leave credit, which really picks up for after the first one left off. So after 10 days, if the employee is unable to work beyond that, because their minor child is not able to go to a school or to a daycare, then once again, an additional credit is available, lesser of two-thirds of the normal salary or $200 a day. This runs for 10 consecutive weeks after that first 10-day period expires. So the total being as much as $1,000 a week, $10,000 in the aggregate. The same additional credit for those people who you're continuing to maintain their health insurance for is available. The next slide just shows each of these in comparison to the other, the sick pay and leave pay. Once again, these are
joining the meeting.
Go, concurrent. So the first one, the sick pay, and then the family leave credit. Okay. real quickly an example of how the credit is taken. So if you assume for a second, during a payroll period, you have a deposit that's necessary, a payroll taxes of $8,000, and you have $5,000 in credits that are available. Instead of making the $8,000 deposit, you make the net of those, the $3,000 deposit. And then when you file your 941, you take the credit for the $5,000 to true up the numbers. If by chance, and this is possible, your credit is greater than the payroll taxes that are owed as of that particular deposit, then you don't have to make any deposit at all and you get a credit carrying forward. Similar credits to these are available for self-employed individuals as well. You take those on the individual income tax return as opposed to the Form 941 payroll form, and you adjust your quarterly deposits in order to make sure that you're taking advantage of this in terms of cash flow currently. Okay, let's jump real quickly to the two provisions that were in the CARES Act. The first one is the employer retention credit, and then the second one is the deferral of the employer match Social Security. So the employer retention credit, once again, another credit that is available on your employment taxes, it's available if the operation of the employer is fully or partially suspended, or if the employer has a reduction in gross receipts of 50% or more in a calendar quarter compared to the calendar quarter of the previous year. And that continues until things get back to semi-normal where they're up to 80% of what they had in the quarter of the previous year. The credit is available to all employers as long as one of those two things exists, regardless of the number of employees. Although if you'll see down there below, if you have over 100 employees, it only applies to the wages that you're paying for people who cannot work. Once again, just like those first two credits, who cannot work. If you're under 100 employees, you get the credit for all of the wages that you pay. And the credit is computed by multiplying 50% times the qualifying wages up to a maximum of $10,000 per employee. Once again, over 100, they have to be not working. Under 100, you get it for all. Even if they are providing services up to that maximum of $10,000. And you'll see, and we're going to go through this in a little more detail, but limitations apply if you're taking advantage of the PPP program. Okay, the one that nearly everyone is able to take advantage of is the delayed payroll tax deposit. And so as most everyone knows, employers are required to match FICA of their employees, and Social Security is the substantial portion of that. It's the 6.2% out of 7.65% that's levied against employers and employees. And for wages paid starting March 27th of this year through the end of the year, all employers can delay paying the employer share of Social Security, that's the 6.2%, until 50% is due December 31st of 2021, and then the other 50% is due December 31st of 2022. So a very significant deferral of this payment to create cash flow for all the businesses that are affected, regardless of whether or not they've had a direct effect by COVID-19 or not. The only limitation, once again, go through this in a little more detail in the next slide, but if you've been notified that you have loan forgiveness of the PPP, at that point you fail to qualify for this program anymore. So all of the deposits that were due prior to getting notification will qualify. Once you receive notification, you can't delay depositing those anymore. One of the things that Sarah was mentioning a while ago is banks are going to want to get this stuff to the SBA and get the loan forgiveness so they'll get reimbursed as quickly as possible. This kind of is counter to that. As long as the employer is sitting out there and hasn't received notification that there's loan forgiveness, then they can continue to participate in the deferral of Social Security taxes, the employer's portion. The next slide, summarizes basically all of the four items that I've just gone through. The most important items are really down there at the bottom, which talks about, the limitations of double dipping associated with the PPP program. So if you're qualifying the PPP program first, you're not, you don't qualify for the employer retention credit at all. And as I mentioned a while ago, if you're delaying your payroll deposits on the Social Security piece for the employer share, after the date of forgiveness doesn't apply anymore. And on those first two credits, any wages that are included in those credit computations can't be used as part of the 75% of wages for loan forgiveness that Sarah went through just a few minutes ago. So limitations there significantly. I'm going to speed through these others real quickly. Most everyone knows about the individual rebate checks. Just note that there's been some discussion recently on the Hill that there may be a second round needed of those, so that's a possibility. Lots of business incentives were also provided, most notably the NOL carryback provision in the current law. No net operating loss carrybacks are available. This new provision allows any losses in 18, 19, or 20 can be carried back for 5 years, and a refund request can be made, once again, trying to generate significant cash flow for businesses that are realizing the impact of COVID-19, and then there were some changes to the charitable deductions. And lastly, I think everyone knows that the filing deadline for anything that was due on April 15th has been pushed to July 15th. If there's a due date other than April 15th with some limited exceptions, there hasn't been an extension, so don't assume that all returns have been extended. That may change, but as of right now, that's the current status. And for those that have been having to deal with collection efforts by the IRS, many of those have taken a back seat by virtue of what's going on. So with that, I'm completed with the tax provisions, and I'm going to hand it over to Bill Sweeney, who's going to go through the employer-related matters, employee benefits, and employment issues. Bill?
Thanks, Bill. I'd like to spend the next several minutes just discussing some of the specific benefit plan opportunities and relief provisions that were made available to employers and plan sponsors, and start with the CARES Act specifically. Under that act, there's a new coronavirus-related distribution opportunity for defined contribution plans, so your 403B plans, 401K plans. And this opportunity is basically to allow the plan participants to take a distribution of up to $100,000 that will be subject to income tax ratably over 3 years at the participant's election, and they can even repay the amount if they chose to. So essentially, the plan would just report the distribution on a 1099, and then the individual participant is going to take the amount into income either ratably over the 3 years or choose to take it into income in a single year, or if they choose to repay the amount taken out, they could do that as well and they won't have any income. The catch obviously here is that the distribution must be coronavirus related. So the recipient or that person's spouse or dependent must have the virus, or the recipient has to have experienced the adverse financial consequences due to being quarantined, furloughed, laid off, or have a loss of child care. So this is a significant opportunity, different from your traditional hardship distributions in that we have these specific coronavirus related terms and that it's a self-certification process. So employers don't necessarily have to specifically approve each distribution. That individual will be self-certifying that they meet these requirements here to be coronavirus related. Additionally, the same types of benefit plans can increase the amount of loans available. So let's say your 401k plan already allows a participant to take a loan. Well, the current limit for that loan is $50,000 or 50% of the vested account balance. Under the CARES Act, those amounts can be up to $100,000 or 100% of the vested account balance, so long as the loan is taken between March 27th and September 23rd. Just like the distributions we talked about a moment ago, they have to be coronavirus related, meaning it's the same group of persons who would be eligible to take that loan. In addition to that special loan amount provision, the CARES Act allows for employers to have no loan repayment requirements for existing and new loans throughout 2020, no required minimum distributions to be made for plan participants. And I think a couple of significant points are, yes, we need to do plan amendments to capture these new plan provisions. The relief is the amendment itself doesn't need to be adopted until sometime in 2022 at the earliest. However, employers need to be working with their record keepers and TPAs to implement these provisions currently if they want to take advantage of those. The Department of Labor and IRS have also been pretty active after the CARES Act in issuing some guidance and some relief, both for individual participants and for plan sponsors. In particular, a final rule was issued just last week that extends some of the deadlines applicable to participants under your ERISA-related benefit plans. Effectively, these rules create a period of time that's disregarded from March 1 through the until 60 days after the end of this national emergency is proclaimed. So, for example, if an individual has a birth of a new child, they would normally have up to potentially 30 days to enroll that new child in your plan. Well, if that birth occurs during this disregarded period, that 30-day period doesn't even start to run. So it gives that person an opportunity to, well, otherwise would be a late enrollment in your plan, but to take advantage of this new disregarded period. The slide here mentions several other deadlines that are extended, more participant-facing. So I urge you to read those and apply those appropriately to your own plans. Similarly, the Department of Labor issued a notice just last week also that extends some of the deadlines more employer-facing. So the ones we talked about a moment ago really were to the benefit of the participants. These are more for the relief of the plan sponsor or the employer so that they don't have to worry about deadlines with respect to certain notices, summary plan description, distribution, summary material modification. And significantly also, the Department of Labor has said that they won't take enforcement action against an employer that has a delay in forwarding loan repayments or contributions that they withhold from an employee's paycheck to the plan trust if it is due to the coronavirus outbreak and during that outbreak period. This is pretty significant because that's an area that the Department of Labor is normally in high enforcement mode, trying to make sure that contributions and loan repayments are put back into a plan as soon as they can be segregated from corporate assets. Finally, and although this is not a new provision under the CARES Act or any relief that has been issued in the past couple of months, I do want to point out that we have been working with a lot of companies and clients that want to implement PTO sharing or donation program, and it is possible to do that. There are very specific requirements that the IRS has, including that it has to be in writing and the donation needs to be tied to a medical emergency or a major disaster, which we obviously are within both of those types of periods right now. So I just urge you to, if you have the need for that, to very specifically look into the requirements, and we're happy to work with you to help implement a program like that so employees can help other employees. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Nelson to talk a little bit more about some of the employer-specific items. Mark, I'm not sure.
Mark, we can't hear you. Mark, we can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. My apologies. Right. As states, cities, and counties relax COVID-19 restrictions, employers are facing questions regarding establishing a safe workplace. And a key component to that is to be able to identify employees who may be sick and present a risk of transmission to other employees. And we have been working with clients of late to try and identify what is best practice for identifying those potential risk agent employees. And at this time, taking employee temperatures when they arrive at work is a best practice for establishing and maintaining a safe and helpful workplace. And the EEOC has even stated at this time that temperature taking in the midst of COVID-19 is a valid and appropriate measure and is a legal practice. So in terms of best practices in this regard, we're recommending that an employer try to engage a trained professional, that is a nurse or other medical professional, to take employees' temperatures. If that isn't feasible, have a management official conduct that testing, could be someone from human resources, and ensure that that individual has been trained by a medical professional and document that training. Use equipment that does not require direct contact. And a big challenge will be maintaining social distancing for employees who are waiting to have their temperature taken. It may require staggered starting and shift end times or workplace modifications for traffic flow or crowding. Now, it's also keep in mind that depending upon federal or state law, the time an employee spends waiting in line to have a temperature taken may have to be paid. Another consideration is, all right, what temperature level is significant? According to the CDC, it's 100.4 and above, but there may be different standards at state and local health departments, so you want to be aware of those. And if you find an employee has a fever, what do we do then? An important element is to inform the employee in a discreet manner that the individual has fever and not allow the employee to enter work. Explain your quarantine procedures and requirements. And then a common standard is the employee cannot return to work for at least 14 days. And then only if the employee can demonstrate he or she has been fever-free for at least 3 consecutive days and has no other COVID-19 symptoms, which seem to be changing on a regular basis. And with that, I will turn it over to Sybil to gaze into the crystal ball.
Great, thank you so much. This is Sybil Vorenbeck. I am in our DC office, and I am just gonna scoot over to this slide. So, I work in the public policy group and was going to give a quick update for folks about what's happening with the next stimulus bill and projections and what we could see in terms of federal legislation. As folks are likely aware, the Congress has recently passed what we've been terming a COVID 3.5 bill, which would give $60 billion more dollars towards some of the stimulus relief programs. In general, you know, the Congress is sort of split in terms of next steps. First, I'll talk about the Senate, and then I'll talk about the House. This week, the Senate is back in session. Leader McConnell has pulled back the Senate, even though there was a lot of opposition from the other party in doing so. This week, they are looking at some COVID-related issues, as well as judicial nominees and other political appointees being confirmed. The Democrats really are pushing in terms of what's happening with the stimulus money so far, as are the Republicans. Just today, Chuck Schumer is trying to bring up a bill which would require additional oversight of stimulus funds that have already been appropriated. The Republicans in general in the Senate have taken sort of a wait-and-see approach with respect to next steps on the stimulus. Publicly, they're saying, let's see what happens with the money that's already gone out before we commit to additional stimulus funding and see how useful that money is and how easily the government can get it out. There are also concerns and disagreements with respect to additional state funding. The GOP is split on whether the federal government should be giving additional money to states, and there's disagreement on that. McConnell has said that any stimulus four that we would see would need to require liability protections for businesses. That's something the Democrats have signaled an unwillingness to do. There are a number of Democrat proposals which have come out more recently specific to the stimulus funds. Joe Manchin has come out with one, which basically would extend the time for some loan repayments under the various programs. Senator Warner has come out with a proposal for $90,000 per furloughed worker. And, you know, where these things, a lot of them are sort of markers, but you can see that we're sort of going back to normal times here on Capitol Hill, where Republicans and Democrats are sort of jockeying for where they are and what policies they're taking up. It's not as much of a perceived, let's all just get together and align around something quickly. And so for that reason, we don't believe that there will be a federal bill passed again until later this month, potentially early June. And that's where we would see any additional stimulus funding. In the
joining
House,
the meeting.
Not in session. We are, there are talks about COVID forward proceeding. Speaker Pelosi and her staff and the relevant committees of jurisdiction have all been working, you know, furiously on coming up with sort of their list of what they would like to see in COVID for. We do expect some sort of list to come out in the next couple weeks as a marker for negotiations. How many of those provisions will actually be included in the next round of legislation, we're not sure, but this is something that we saw happen in the COVID-3 CARES Act negotiations as well. And we expect that in addition to stimulus measures, that there will also be a number of other measures related to you know, businesses, healthcare measures, a more expansive set of policies than perhaps we've seen in prior iterations of the stimulus legislation. You know, it's anybody's guess how quickly the next piece will come together, but we do expect that there will be additional work both on the oversight and enforcement side with respect to the stimulus money, as well as making sure that small businesses and larger businesses are shored up. There's been increased attention not only to the airline industry, but also to some of the meat and food and agriculture industries. So we expect to see more there as well. But it's getting more, you know, partisan every day. There's been less of a sort of rolling this together kind of mentality on the Hill in the last couple of weeks. And so it's going to be a little bit hairy getting there, but we do expect something to come in the next 5 or 6 weeks. So with that, I will post to our next slide, which shows a number of our different resources that the firm has with respect to COVID-19. Please email our cross-department response team at the email listed there, or reach out to the attorney that you regularly work with at Polsinelli with any additional questions. And I will turn it over to Ashley to wrap up.
Great, thank you. This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation and copy of the slides will be available on the Polsinelli website in the COVID-19 blog within 24 hours. If you have questions regarding today's content, we encourage you to reach out to our COVID-19 task force. Thank you for your participation.